Welcome everyone to the latest version of the Form 3 podcast. I'm joined today by Karen Rudich, CEO of Elementary B. Welcome, Karen.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. And thank you for having me.
No, not a problem.
This beautiful weather that we're having.
I know, forcing you to stay indoors, eh?
Indeed.
So I wanted to kick off just to put in a bit of context, I guess, about your background, how you've got to where you are, and where the sort of concept of Elementary B came from.
Okay. Well, thank you. So my background is I am an engineer by trade. I came to the UK in the late 90s and helped to set up a dot-com. At the tail end of the dot-com boom, we listed on AIM. Then looked to banking and went into capital markets and never really looked back. I have been in banking for over 20 years, absolutely loved it, very much where my home became quants and modeling, equities, fixed income. I then decided that I needed to really understand the ins and outs of banking, so went into operations. I've been in risk. I've managed pretty big transformation programs for Barcap, Barclays, Barwealth, Lloyd's. In 2013, I then came out of banking and decided to set up my own company, Firedrake. And initially, we were doing large-scale transformations between capital markets and commercial banking. And later on, we started developing our own integration platform called BBox, and I sold that last year. And I guess out of all of my experience, that's where the idea for Elementary B was born. Having managed what we call a mid-sized company, so companies with turnover between £6 and £100 million, you realize how the market is not really set out to help you meet your customized needs and your pain points. And everything is swimmingly. You hear a lot from your financial providers when you don't need them. And then suddenly when cash is a little bit tight, there's nobody there to be found or things are not suitable. So that's where the idea for Elementary B came from.
Yeah. So that's really it's focused on addressing, I guess, the business needs that the traditional banking processes don't address.
So it's a little bit more than that. To me, helping organizations is about more than just banking. So banking is just, to me, one slice of the big pie. It really is around giving them good data to help them make those decisions. And decisions are mostly of a financial nature, but also performance and risk management capabilities in order to optimize their businesses. And that really is the area that Elementary B is hoping to move into. It's to look at all of the needs of mid-sized companies, look at the aggregation of their data so they can start, you know, comparing apples to apples, then surface useful insights that they can then model in a kind of like a forward-looking approach, and then tap them into a marketplace of products and solutions that are there for the mid-sized company sector, as opposed to trying to use unsuitable products or the next best thing, or maybe they don't get the best price because they don't have the web that can span across all of their needs.
So in current times, I guess, things have been highlighted even more so. We'd be amiss if we didn't mention COVID-19 and the current situation, obviously. Do you think that has highlighted any further inefficiencies that banks or the SMEs, MMEs, mid-cap businesses face from their banks?
Yeah, absolutely. I think any kind of black swan situation just highlights the fact that if you are unable to have real-time access and understanding of exactly what your company status is, and therefore you don't even understand what your options are, it's very difficult to make those decisions. And that transcends to not just lending, which is the big gap that we're seeing right now, emergency funding for companies. You know, that transcends to other issues, supplier, trade and supply chain risk, products, international currency payments in particular, where you've got exposures across different currencies because you've got suppliers and clients. When we look at the mid-size sector in particular, 80% of them have import-export needs. So that is incredibly material for them to really be able to understand what are their options when they're managing their issues, not just at home, but in their international markets. That also transcends into insurance products. into being able to risk manage and optimize their business in any kind of an emergency situation. So unfortunately, yes, I think this has been exacerbated by COVID, but it is not, unfortunately, the only time when companies have seen that they don't necessarily have the best tools at their fingertips to be able to optimize.
It relates, I guess, to where the banks are at and how quickly the banks can modify and change. I mean, obviously, you've worked substantially in change and transformation. Do you see sort of underlying issues within a bank that's preventing them moving quickly or modifying quickly?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's not for lack of great effort to transform inside of the banks, but it is you're moving a huge destroyer. And it's going to take you a long time to do a 360-point turn. And the legacy is, everybody knows it's a big issue for banks, that means, but a lot of things are paper-based. And it is difficult to get in data in and out of their systems. It's not just exhaustive to their technology. It's also down to the governance processes, their approvals processes, even affecting things like client onboarding. You know, you hear a lot about how FinTech Challenger and other kind of neobanks are able to onboard clients in a matter of minutes or 2 days of duration for businesses, whereas the banks is still taking them, you know, upwards of 95 days, and they still have 300-page paper forms. They can't tap into data sources because of internal regulatory or risk and compliance challenges. So they have a massive challenge in being able to digitize, let alone modernize, and therefore deal with immediate emergency situations. And I think that's what we've seen really directly translate into the CBILS and the emergency funding that the government was trying to release through the big banks, and how that has come a little bit short.
Yeah, so I guess in a situation like this, it's similar to flight to safety with currency. You know, if when in a crisis, you fly to US dollar, invest in US dollar, for example. But in this situation, businesses are looking to their traditional banks, you know, so they're almost flight to safety, or what they know best is the banks, the traditional banks. And my question is, how do you see, or what do you see the financial service providers at the moment? What's the importance of them in this situation? What should they be doing in this situation to give comfort to businesses?
It's a duty of the big banks, particularly in the UK, where the top banks are really the main holders of money and protection and trust with customers. The alternative lenders and the challengers haven't really gotten up to that level yet. And therefore, whether they like it or not, they have a duty to society and to companies and to individuals to ensure that they are fulfilling that duty of protecting them and of letting them know that not only are they keeping their money safe during the good times, but they're there for them during the bad times. I think they've been doing that fairly successfully, actually. But I think it's something that, you know, it just can't be dropped. Where they will struggle is in being able to almost tailor that message and that service to the companies and the individuals that don't fall into your traditional buckets, the vanilla buckets that are easy to service. And because there are a lot of outliers out there, we've seen this with the government funding program, but then they've had to release subsequent ones to help the self-employed, for example, or SMEs that don't have that historical capability that was required to access some of those lending options that they were filtering out. So I think, yes, you know, that flag to fly still falls upon the shoulders of the giant banks. We've seen some that are not dealing with it very well, especially when they were asking for collateral to hold loans that should have been collateral free. And that is going to come back and impact them in the future. I do think that that's going to change significantly the perception of some of the banks once we come out of the situation.
And I think it's a bit of a make or break, isn't it? We're going to see certain challenges really float to the surface out of this process. You know, they're going to come out smelling of roses because of how well they've dealt with the situation.
I think at the moment we're heading into one of the world's biggest recessions ever in recorded history, really. Opportunism and commercialism right now is bad. You mentioned international payments, international currency, hedging in particular. There are companies that they don't have a choice. Again, they have to be able to manage their subsidiaries in other countries to ensure that they're also surviving, because it also always comes back home. And big banks in particular are charging still atrocious fees for products and services, transactional effects in particular. It's a £4 billion overcharged industry per year.
Yeah.
It's those things where you kind of will look back as a CEO of a company, and when you identify the fact that the banks didn't help you out during the tough times, you're going to start asking questions about the value of that relationship going forward.
Yeah. Well, I think we're almost getting to a tipping point at the moment where there is so many disruptive businesses within that space, us obviously included. It's only a matter of time before banks are really going to have to get their, you know, their acts together as far as pricing is concerned, product availability. And I think we're starting to see that. It's going to take a long time, granted. And obviously that's why we're doing what we're doing for banks to be able to very quickly introduce a transactional FX proposition without having to disrupt too much. So that sort of brings me quite nicely onto the next question. Over the next sort of decade or so, how do you see banking changing? Is it going to be traditional banks, or is it going to be a combination of challengers, or is it going to be some real standout challengers that have floated to the surface? Or similarly, is it going to be a Facebook or an Amazon that is leading the charge as far as banking is concerned?
I think it's going to be all of the above, actually. I think the future is bright. Competition is even brighter. And I think the only people that benefit from increased competition are the consumers and the customers at the end of the day. So I want to see as many challengers, as many fintech, as many tech, large tech companies, obviously subject to privacy data laws, and banks out there competing, because that's how we're going to get the best prices for the consumer and the businesses and the customers. I would love to see more of an embracing of new technology. That's what we're doing at Elementary B, is we are putting together a business model where the consumer sits at the heart of everything we do. We are there to make sure that not only do they understand their world better, but they have access through a marketplace of products and solutions that are suitable to them. We are also creating a regulatory framework that is there designed to protect them going forward. And this is across their financial risk and insurance worlds. And we're quite agnostic of who it is that we need to put in front of a customer, as long as we are there to put the best solutions in front of the customers. So I would love to be able to see more focus on customer needs. And I think, again, you can only get that through competition.
Yeah. I've heard the term race to the bottom an awful lot, you know, and I think there's a balance to strike between something being too cheap to be able to be sustainable and something that is right for the customer to provide them with a level of service and product quality that allows them to manage their business and manage their day-to-day operations to the best they can. And I do think some of these very, very cheap products that are almost being pushed around at the moment, I don't think that is a sustainable market and will have to change at some point. I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on that.
I 100% agree with you. I think it's around suitability. It's around customization, and that doesn't come cheap, right? It's also around protection. And in a world where cybersecurity is going through its biggest challenge on the back of, you know, all the hacking and the fraud that is taking place digitally, even on the back of COVID, is horrific. That means that companies are having to up their investment in the cyberspace and the protection and the fraud detection space significantly. And that doesn't come cheaply, but I, as a customer, would rather protect my livelihood and my family and pay for it with the trust and understanding that somebody is looking after it, than to buy something cheap and cheerful for immediate satisfaction or gratification that actually then comes back with open risk a week down the line, and suddenly my banking details are out in the public domain, and my bank accounts are empty, my business is suddenly being held for ransom. We've done a lot of research with mid-sized companies in particular. None of them said that they wouldn't pay for good quality service. None of them said that they wouldn't pay for banking as long as it was good quality customized hand-holding and value-adding advice and service. I think in Britain in particular, people are used to being are used to paying for quality, but they do expect quality. And I think that's where you will see the race for that competition. It is those companies that take the time to invest in value and quality and get their price point correctly that will succeed over the mass market of cheap and cheerful.
Yeah, well, buy cheap, buy twice, hey? I guess is, yeah.
The, is the key there. Buy cheap, buy twice, and pay 10 times eventually, well, exactly. Right?
That's the problem, especially when you're talking about compliance. I think that's the brilliant thing about, I guess, reg tech, financial technology that's coming around. You know, you have the ability through your API technology to automatically update regulation. I know Form 3 do that through their technology layer, both on the international proposition and also our access to scheme, which obviously means the burden doesn't necessarily fall as much with the bank. And that's the beauty of technology. When we talk about financial technology and fintech firms, you know, there is a big appetite at the moment to help SME business. That, you know, there's a big wave around SME business banking, but also I guess what we're talking about with you is the upper end of that SME bracket. So I was wondering why you think that SMEs and mid caps are slightly overlooked. You know, where's that issue stem from?
Part of it is experience. I've been in banks where we have offboarded clients that were not profitable because they weren't generating over 25K of fees. And this was over a decade ago in terms of fees for the banks, right? Because the banks do have a big legacy book. They do have big legacy technology. It's expensive for them to service clients. And if you're losing money hand over fist and trying to figure out where you're going to squeeze money out in order to invest in innovation and upgrades, something's got to give. And so that's one area. I guess it comes from experience. The second one was my own self-experience where we were an MME. Yeah. And suddenly you come from banking and you know what the products are that are available out there. You know what they look like for big institutional clients and for large corporates. And suddenly you realize that they're not there for you because you don't have £1 billion of annual turnover. You just got 10 million pounds. And you're like, but I'd like to be able to buy that product. Yeah. I know from a regulatory perspective that I can consume that product. But yet the banks are unable to provide that product to the mid-size sector profitably. So they're not there for them. So it was clearly a gap in the market. And you've seen a lot of focus over the last 5 to 10 years from challengers popping up under the woodwork, Starling, Monzo, Tide. They are very much focused around the smaller sector where it's more simple. Now, I love this story because it's very close to my heart, as you can imagine. We try to open up a bank account. So all of the directors at Elementary B are British. I think maybe there's one, which is me, that was not British born. All of us have worked for the big banks. One of them even has an MBE, and we couldn't even open a bank account for mm-hmm. our company. We went through 3-4 places, and we were directed to the small SME business banking units of the big banks. The first question that we failed at was, if you have more than 2 founders, directors on the roster, you then need to go into the large corporate unit. Yeah. And actually, when you get to the large corporate unit, they kind of ping pong you back and they're like, well, we need 6 months of your annual account statement. And you're like, well, we've literally just started trading. We haven't even started trading. We just need a bank account to put in the investment that we've received. So I had heard about this issue before, but I just assumed it was because of risk and history. I'd never had an issue opening up a bank account, even for my previous companies. And suddenly you realize that actually the world is not created for companies that don't fit into a very specific cookie cutter design. Mm. So it was a combination of our own experience looking out in the market. We started carrying out research, having conversations with CFOs and CEOs of mid-sized companies. The problems just get bigger and bigger, particularly in certain industries. The construction industry in particular suffers. Clients up north are completely disadvantaged because a lot of products are designed for the globalized nature of London, for example.
Yeah.
And I think that's where we decided, actually, nobody's looking after this sector, yet the sector contributes over 30% of business annual turnover, and it employs a huge chunk of people out there. So we thought enough was enough. Somebody's got to do something about it. Yeah. So we put our hands up.
Yeah. You know, from my experience in the FX world, you know, we were dealing with SME mid-cap businesses on a regular basis, whether they were new or whether they were established. And the same story goes on every time. Oh, we've struggled opening a bank account. Can we use these guys? You can't use them because they're not a regulated bank. They're just an e-money license. So it's a very difficult problem that needs to be solved. And I think as well, it's very difficult to build a business around, if you do get a bank account open, you don't get access to all the products, and your business might have been contingent on you getting that loan or you getting that trade finance product or being able to fix a rate for 12 or 18 months on your FX exchange, because that's what will allow you to do your business. And if you don't get access to that, you can't forecast, you can't grow, you can't develop. So it's a difficult problem.
It is.
I know you're aware, Form 3 were given some funding from the BCR, and the BCR's focus is all around SME product development, you know, developing better access, more cost effective, more transparency, etc. And there's been a lot of entrants into that market, the SME market. You talk Redwood, Shawbrook, Oak North, but these guys are focusing on lending. They're focusing on access to cash. Is there a reason for that? But I mean, why is it that we always see people going into the lending and not necessarily the transactional banking?
I think it comes down to where can you make the biggest bang for your buck? traditional banking models are designed to generate most of its revenue from interest, and actually its revenue is fees and interest from interest related products. At Elementary B, we're actually trying to start a slightly different business model where the majority of our revenue doesn't come from interest bearing products and services, but that was because we saw that it was a fairly saturated market out there. That said, there's still a massive demand to fund those working capital needs.
You know, in order for a business to run successfully, do you think that there are a set number of key products that they need access to?
So yeah, if I'm expanding outside of purely banking, so from a banking perspective, it's those you know, being able to manage your cash, ins and outs, and your future needs. Insurance absolutely must have, because you just never know what's going to happen and you need to protect yourself, your employees, and your clients. When it comes to services, you need to have those accounting services in place. We live in a very tax efficient and now digital tax efficient environment. You need to be able to understand what your exposure going forward and the impact into your cash flow is going to be. How much runway do you have? I would love to be able to then see, which is what we're adding to Elementary B, the protection side to it. And protection translates into the form of cyber and fraud. Protection for our customers, protecting their data, protecting their transactions, protecting their organizations from being used as vehicles. That would be my foundational aspiration. I think as we grow, we'd love to be able to see increased access to more complex products by companies, capital markets in particular, where they can purchase in bulk, where they can have services and automation that enables them to take advantage of the markets moving, such as netting and sweeping, offsetting and pooling capabilities. We do have a lot of treasury services that organizations, especially at the larger end of the mid-sized sector, really need, and it shouldn't be as expensive as they are. As we look into the future as well, I think it's very important that we're able to bring in some of the sustainable and green products, green finance products into the mid-sized sector as well. Carbon offsetting, you know, we need to be able to contribute to our targets for improving the environment in the future. And I don't think that it's been thought through enough to give access to this mid-sized sector across the product. So we would like to be able to bring that through our marketplace. So companies can start putting key performance indicators around their own personal goals and objectives to contribute to that for the future of our children. So I think it's a huge opportunity, but some of the basic ones, I think I went over your basic requirement there.
We see quite a good appetite from SMEs to work with fintech firms. You know, you look at the likes of Starling, they're opening an awful lot of business bank accounts. Tide are doing a similar thing. My question is around what the appetite you think there is for mid-cap businesses, because, you know, in the grand scheme of things, mid-cap businesses are relatively well established. They've probably got pretty good roots within their traditional banking relationship or the four that they might have to have in order to manage everything. So what do you see as their appetite to move towards the fintech avenue or the fintech space?
So I'm going to be pretty brutal on this one. I don't think that for the mid-sized sector, moving their primary banking relationship is going to be an easy sell for fintechs. It's based down to trust. It's based down to risk adversity, right? If I've got to keep millions of pounds into a bank, I'm going to make sure that I keep them in with one that is, you know, protected by the government and you know, years of history, etc. I may not like them and I may not get the best service, but it's kind of, you know, it's a risk-based approach because you have to think about your employees. Where I do think, however, that there's a massive opportunity is in the products that those mid-sized companies consume. And, you know, buying FX, buying payments, buying specialist finance, trade and supply chain services, treasury type of services, corporate credit cards, etc. You don't have to pay over the odds to source these products from your expensive bank. This is where fintech and the opportunity to get economies of scale, new technology, better quality for less money because of the cost income ratios. It's a great opportunity for companies to think to utilize these fintechs for. Now, I think this is a key thing that we've built into the elementary B proposition, which is not to really force anybody to switch their bank accounts, but actually to enable them to look at their entire financial view across all of their multiple bank accounts, because a lot of mid-sized companies in particular, especially as they get bigger, they have multiple banking relationships, not just in the UK, but also in their other countries that they operate under, to be able for them to see this, all of those bank accounts, either cut them across different currencies, if they need to, be able to aggregate all of their euro accounts across three or four different jurisdictions, and all of their financial products that enables them to then say, okay, if I have gathered a loan from another provider, and I've got three bank accounts in the UK, two bank accounts here, what does my cash flow and my working capital look like in a holistic approach? So I think this is where collaboration is critical and key for the fintech community.
Yeah, I agree. As far as where you're at now and the impact of what's gone on over the last 2-3 months, how has that impacted your plans as far as launching a go-to-market is concerned?
We were due to go for a fundraise for pre-round A. We have been front-loading a lot of the governance and what we call the due diligence side of building a larger organization. We were due to go out for fundraising in March, and that got a little bit knocked back, mostly because having tech workshops with business guys to design product is not the same in the digital space, but you know, we've managed now, thankfully. We are going for a fundraise now, and we're hoping that we will be able to get supporters that kind of want to challenge the world for what it is. Regardless, you know, we really need to focus on the recovery of Britain, the economic recovery. And that will enable us to spin up teams and development teams, actually, to come up with an MVP next year. You know, time will tell, as we are fundraising in a very challenging economic environment.
Time. Yeah, indeed. Indeed. Well, look, it's rather you than me, I say. And I think if there's anyone for the job, I think it's yourself. So thank you ever so much for your time. It's very much appreciated. I wish you all the best for 2020. And I hopefully we'll be back, be able to meet for a coffee at some point soon.
Oh, that would be fantastic. You're going to have to make that a stiff drink, I'm afraid, having been in lockdown.
No problem at all. Thank you very much. If you would like to hear more about Payments Insights, then please subscribe for the next episode. See you next time.